who had married a Rothschild, and who was became, for a very short time, Liberal Prime Minister of Great Britain.
Well, we also know that since Tricelli, Britain has lost any independence from these criminals. I mean, that was when everything was turned over to them, lock, stock, and barrel. And, some people could say Cromwell did it, but I got to say, the real consolidation happened under Tricelli. Do you agree with that?
I go back a bit further to Nathan Rothschild and the defeat of Napoleon at Waterloo, because he bought up the entire London Stock Exchange when, like today, you know, the value of stocks had gone down.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm talking about the political process was still up up for grabs until this man Tricelli took the political process in complete monopoly at that point.
Well, let's get back to this question of intermarriage. I mean, they not only intermarried with prominent Gentile families, prominent in politics, because politics in Britain at that time was dominated by an aristocratic elite, but so they bought themselves into positions of power, but they consolidated their power by endogamy, by marriage within the tribal unit. That is to say, the Sassoons, who are known as the Rothschilds of the East, married the Rothschilds of the West, and that way they consolidated their power. Now, you mentioned opium. Now, the Sassoons, I think, became prominent in the opium trade a bit later, about the 1870s. The person who was really behind the first opium war was Palmerston, and Palmerston was a Freemason. This is a dimension of the problem we haven't spoken of much yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, it was the free traders who wanted to impose opium on China, and they controlled the parliament, because they had tremendous political influence in determining who would get elected to parliament. So they used their agents in the House of Commons to declare war on China. As you know, there were two opium wars. And it left China, the oldest civilization in the world, wrecked, because, you see, there was the drain of silver. China had a bimetallism currency. There was no gold. The currency was based on silver and copper. Copper means cash. So we have still of the word cash in English, meaning money in general. But cash really is the copper coinage of China. Now, this upset, the drain of silver from the country, upset the relationship between the two metals in the Chinese national currency, and the result was rampant inflation, and ultimately it's that brought down the Chinese empire and brought the people like Sun Yat-sen and Chiang Kai-shek and all these people who were products of the missionary schools to power, who sold China out to the Americans. It wasn't just the Sassoons who were exporting opium from Bombay to Canton and Shanghai, and incidentally they worked along with the Tongs, you know, the Swatow Gangsters Guild. It was also the Delanos. Now, you go to your country, who is the famous president who inveigled Japan into attacking Pearl Harbor in 1941?
Yes, Franklin
Roosevelt. Right. Nobody can become a president of the United States without being a millionaire. It costs a fortune. Where did the Roosevelt fortune come from? It came from the Delanos, and the Delanos were opium smugglers. And you know, Franklin Roosevelt never once alluded to the source of his family fortune. And he's deified in this country, and you go to Grosvenor Square, and there's a statue to him there facing the American embassy.
Well, you know, let's move on to this Freemason movement. Now, what we do know is the Guild of Freemasons that built the great cathedrals of Europe, and they are great. If you if any of our listeners in South Africa have not seen these buildings, they are really truly remarkable.
Particularly the French cathedrals. I mean, there's nothing like them, really. Each time I visit Saint-Denis, the burial place of the French kings, it's a spiritually uplifting experience.
Yes, the buildings are really remarkable, but that the Freemasonry knowledge that they kept as part of their guild was not usurped until this movement of the Illuminati decided that they would fan out across Europe and stop morphing their organization and infiltrating every major organization already in existence. And that was when the Grand Orient Lodge of Paris was infiltrated by Jews and Jewish money. And they came in clandestinely to the organization in the first instance, but ultimately took the organization over in its entirety. Am I correct?
Well, this is one of the mysteries of history, how a Catholic guild, that's to say the Masons who built the great cathedrals of the Middle Ages, became an anti-Catholic, anti-religious, anti-monarchical, secular organization, all of it summed up in the Grand Lodge of the Orient, which is the parallel government of France. But that, we're jumping ahead a bit. The thing is, why was Freemasonry so suitable as a vehicle for these people? Well, Europe hinted at it already. The Masons who built those cathedrals with sometimes, 150 feet above the ground, these people were engineers of genius. They were geniuses. Now, they were, therefore, like all geniuses, they were most unwilling to let their secrets escape, because once other people learn your secret, they can start to rival your achievement. So they had this code, the language of secret signs and recognition signals that they used, the Masonic marks that you can find in medieval churches, for instance, left behind from one Mason to another. Now, this was ideal. This coded language was ideal for a society that wanted to keep its operations secret. Now, the Masons, they say their objectives are charitable, that they're engaged in benevolent good works. But why secrecy? I mean, as you know, Dal, I'm an Orientalist. I'm a student of Oriental history. I know that most secret societies throughout history have been criminal organizations, like the Tongs in China, the Hashashin, the assassins in Islam, from whom, in fact, European Masonry may derive in some respects, and and the mafia in your country and in Italy. So a secret society, if it's all clear and above board, why does it need to be secret?
That's right. But what we need to understand here, though, James, is the infiltration and the changing of the whole mentality of the organization being turning into a Kabbalistic organization where the Kabbalah was part of what they were beginning to teach within this Grand Orient tradition. Am I correct?
Well, I understand a lot of Freemasonry, the language used, the symbols and all that are Talmudic.
Yes, they are. And in fact, there are two types of...
And nobody reads the Talmud except the Jews, because if Christians knew what was in the Talmud, they'd be horrified.
Well, and I mean, the Muslims are also victimized by that Talmud, too, because everybody who's not a Jew is cattle in their minds.
Yeah, got you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now the York Rite Freemasonry has 8 levels, whereas the Grand Orient level has 33.
Yeah.
And
Aleister Crowley, you know, who was called in his lifetime by the press the wickedest man in the world, he was a 33 degree Mason.
Yes.
The Satanist.
And so was Albert Pike.
Ah, yes.
So, I mean, and he was as evil as you could possibly be, and so was this guy, House, that was very instrumental.
Well, Colonel House.
Oh, yeah.
He's the sinister figure behind Wilson, and Wilson is one of the 13 American presidents who were Masons.
That's right.
Let me read you their names, just for the benefit of your audience who might not know this. The list of Masonic presidents controlling the politics of the United States begins right at the start with George Washington and proceeds to Monroe, Jackson, Polk, Buchanan, Johnson, Garfield, McKinley, Theodore Roosevelt, that's most sinister of characters, Taft, Harding, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and his running mate, Truman.
Yeah.
Others may have been Masons. But the only one who was certainly not a Mason, because he was a Catholic, was Kennedy.
Mm.
And
Kennedy,
when these people, like for instance the CIA, want somebody assassinated, you know, the bodyguard of every head of state in the non-communist world is, whether the head of state be aware of the fact or not, trained by the CIA. So whenever Washington wants somebody robbed out, an order goes out to relax the security cordon round about the target so that the assassin gets through. And this is what happened in Kennedy's case, just as it happened in Liaquatali's in Pakistan. Each of these was assassinated by somebody who was subsequently either died or was subsequently assassinated by somebody else. The man who assassinated Liaquatali in Pakistan was shot by the man standing next to him. And they held set up three commissions of inquiry. First arrived at no clear conclusion. Set up a second. It arrived at no clear conclusion. And for the third one, they handed it over to Scotland Yard, who had done it. So, and the same with Kennedy. I mean, we'll never find out the truth about the Kennedy assassination.
I think I have a good idea, James. Let me tell you that it was an Israeli hit.
You give me your hypothesis, and I'll give you mine.
I believe it was an Israeli hit because he was doing two things. One, he was starting to rattle the cage of the bankers by saying he wanted to begin to look at ways of the Treasury starting to print money once again. And the second thing he did was he was in complete opposition to Israel getting technology to build a nuclear reactor and then the bomb at Dannemora. And
your
the fact of the matter is,
coincides with mine. I think the reason Kennedy was done in was because he had ordered an investigation of the Israeli atom bomb, and they had stop him. And Johnson, immediately he took over, when he took that oath of office in the presence of Jacqueline Kennedy, he ordered that investigation stopped.
And he also got rid of the presidential order that of printing money through the Treasury at the same time. He did it both on the plane.
Oh, he did them both on board the plane before he'd even got there.
On his way to Washington, D.C., those two presidential orders were issued. So he got rid of the two things that the bankers and the Jews, criminal Jews in the world, wanted to
even before he was trying to occupy the White House and the Oval Office. Well, that is amazing. But I tell you something else about this fellow Johnson. By the way, I almost met his daughter once. She was on tour in Spain and came to the Alhambra, was being shown around by my professor of archaeology. But I didn't relish the meeting, so we didn't meet up. Anyway, the 1967 war took place between Israel and Egypt, Israel had this lightning victory in Sinai, and they had more POWs than they could handle. Well, there was an American ship from the Sixth Fleet. It was a communications vessel, a spy vessel really, which was monitoring the progress of the battle in Sinai, and by sheer chance it happened to be stationed off the Sinai coast, precisely at the point opposite which the Israelis were executing POWs.
That was at El Alarish, and they were murdering they were making them dig their own graves, and they were asking them to jump in the grave and shooting them dead, and the next guy would have to dig his grave. And you can hear, I've had James Innes, who was the officer of the deck on that ship, on my show five times.
Yeah. No.
And he said clearly it was because the information that they had gathered on that ship would have shown terrible and murderous war crimes.
Well, this was it. And the Israelis attempted to sink the ship.
Yeah.
And when it got out in Washington that it was Israel and not Egypt that had attacked the vessel, the Pentagon wanted to send the Sixth Fleet to bombard Haifa. Who stopped it? President Johnson.
Yep. That's right. And in fact, Johnson, along with John McCain's father, John McCain's father was instrumental in covering up the investigation along with Admiral Kidd.
Oh, so the McCains are another political dynasty.
Yes, they are, and they are very close knit with the Brockman fortune and the Seagram's fortune out of Canada.
So that's where the campaign funds come from. In other words, they belong to the oligarchs, don't they?
Yeah,
because
and it's
America's not a democracy, it's an oligarchy.
Well, you know, the first Esther of this modern era was not this recent stuff that we've talked about, you know, where a Jewess gets involved in a political marriage, but Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy was the first Jewess to be the Esther of our modern world, and was instrumental in the demise of her husband, I believe.
Really?
Oh yeah,
I thought she was Catholic.
Nope. And her first real marriage, they say, in the Jewish community, was to Onassis, because that was the Jew that she married after the death of her husband, of Kennedy.
Was Onassis Jewish? He was buried in a Greek Orthodox chapel on that island he owned.
His family fortune, and now this is another thing what we have to talk about here, is crypto-Judaism.
It's a very important phenomenon. I mean, we're talking about dead Jews masquerading as Catholics and masquerading as Orthodox. Do you know that in the 17th century, they discovered in Mexico that the Archbishop of Mexico, who was buried in Mexico City Cathedral, had all along been a Jew. They dug up the body and burned it in the square outside.
How about John Paul, the last pope, was also, his mother was Jewish, and how about this one? How about Madeleine Albright? General Wesley Clark, the man who almost started World War III in the Balkans, Jewish? How about, we can go on and on. Here's the interesting thing. These people claim John Kerry, the person who ran for president, he is a Khan family, Jewish. The fact is that they use crypto-Judaism as a means of getting into places of power unbeknownst to the societies around them. And they have seemingly names that would seemingly be fixed within the society as being Christian. Or in the case of Islam, I'm sure even Islamic names. These people have no shame when it comes to claiming another religion to get benefit.
In Central Asia, you can't tell the difference between a Central Asian Jew and a Central Asian Muslim except by their appearance. Surprisingly enough, the Central Asian Jews are very, very ugly, and that's the only way you can tell them. But when I was an undergraduate at university before I emigrated to Spain, the most beautiful girls were the Jewesses. But it certainly doesn't apply in Central Asia. And they all have Muslim names. Abdurrahman, Abdus Samad, Abdul Basit, Abdul this, Abdul that. You can't tell the difference.
That's right.
Well, they are chameleons. You see, they are cultural chameleons and also religious ones. And it does surprise me. Well, it should not surprise me, Wesley Clark, because you told me once before about Eisenhower. See, I thought that Jews always shied away from military service because they don't like being killed. But in fact,
I didn't see the Star of David on his grave. What I did see is in his yearbook from West Point, his nickname was the Terrible Jew.
Oh, I've been to West Point. I must go back.
Yeah.
Well.
I since we've made a big stink of that, you're going to have to get an older copy to read it, I think, these days. But you probably could find that on the net. You know, James, we're in the last throes here of our opportunity to take this world back from these crooks. I think we do have an opportunity, though. When things start getting desperate in the world, there's no real way to know how it's all going to shake out. And I see that there's going to be a lot of moments in the upcoming years that we face periods where they're not going to be so sure if they can continue their monopoly on things, because I believe the world is finding out about these people. You know, let's talk about this for a second. How many times have they been kicked out of countries? This means that people have found them out. They have been outed, and they have been caught in their crimes and their lies, and the societies they were in were outraged and threw them out. The fact is that there's another pogrom coming.
It started with England in 1290, the edict of Edward I, England's greatest king, and that spread Spain, Portugal, all the countries in Europe.
Well, I mean, could we hope that enough people wake up to these facts, both in Islam and in Christianity, and say, wait a minute, we've been duped, we've been lied to, and we've been used and criminalized here by these people, and it's time to take them away from from the levers of power and get rid of these people from our lives?
Well, I mean, what do you think will arise out of the present crisis? It seems we're back to 1929, or perhaps even worse. But what
That's
happened
right.
in 1929? These Zionist corporations bought up all the stocks at rock bottom prices, didn't they? So they emerged infinitely enriched by it.
Whenever but their numbers aren't bigger, James.
Their money.
But James, their numbers haven't grown since. The fact is they may on paper have more stuff, but if the societies they're stealing from find out who is to blame, it may be their undoing, because these people have no sense of timing, it seems to me.
Oh?
I mean, they've got hubris. They don't think that they're gonna lose.
Yeah, well, it's true. They are very arrogant, aren't they? So you're right. It is hubristic. Yeah, they think they are infallible. Mm.
Well,
yeah,
they have
a superiority complex vis-a-vis the Gentile world. But that's our fault, because we let them get off with it.
Well, I can tell you right now, there are millions and millions of people worldwide who today know the facts as I've explained them, and there are millions more coming to the facts every day. I ask people that listen to my broadcast and people who read things on the net and everything to do their own research to find out if I've made a mistake. And if I do, James, I try to immediately correct my errors. But the fact is, on by and large, you can't be wrong by reading Nesta Webster or by Elizabeth Dilling's work or by Archibald Moll Ramsey or Arnold Leith. Or Jack Bernstein, or I mean, come on, we can Benjamin Friedman. Listen to these people. Once you've heard and know the conspiracy, you are clear that it is exactly the way I've been laying it out, and you've been laying it out right from the start, James.
Well, I mean, there are undoubtedly good Jews. What about Israel Shamir? He's taken the lid off Zionism, hasn't he, and exposed the rottenness underneath. And
I'll have you know that your name on my Rolodex card is right above Israel Shamir's phone number.
Oh, really? Oh, well.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, the last I heard, he went off to one of the Baltic countries, I think Estonia.
Yes.
Uh-huh. I was trying to contact him, actually, but didn't succeed. But I did attend his lecture at Westminster Cathedral in London. It was very good, extremely witty and urbane. He's a good speaker.
Well, you know, we face challenges.
Entirely impromptu. You know, he spoke without notes and straight from the heart. So I don't want to make this a blanket condemnation of all Jews. I've known excellent Jews, and I think many, perhaps indeed the majority of Jews, are as much victims of these conspirators as we are ourselves.
I think 80% of the Jewish community is victimized, and they've been lied to. And I think truly the only about 20% of the Jewish community has any kind of role in this, even small. I don't think they have a majority in any way.
The Zionist elite, they trade on their insecurities and the Jewish neuroses and all the rest of it.
Yes,
to
they
claim
do.
Leadership.
And I believe you're correct in that, and I don't condemn all Jews. In fact, much of the research that I place on my website comes from the Jewish community itself. So the fact is, I agree with you, and I don't think this should be about Jews. It should be about criminal Jews.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. It's a challenge, James, and you know as well as I do, we're all going to be affected. Can you maybe?
Well, we are. I mean, what's your reading of this crisis? You see, the last time, the Wall Street crash of 1929, things were different from what they were today. Hitler was waiting in the wings, and beside him his financial wizard Schacht. And as for Britain, Britain tried to isolate her not only herself but her empire from the fluctuations of international finance by the Imperial Preferences Agreement, which was signed at Ottawa. Now, one of America's conditions for entering the Second World War on the British side was that the British abolished the Imperial Preferences system. And immediately the war was over, in 1945, our Labour government abolished it. Which
doesn't it? I got to tell you that in the 29 crash, in life through the 30s, many people still lived on farms, and many people lived in rural environments that could grow food. Today, that's not true. Most people live in mega cities.
Today,
they have no way to
grow. The population of the world in 1929 and 30 was 2 billion people. Today, it's 6 billion. So
the
famine will be frightful.
Yes. It's already starting in Africa.
I mean, it took a year for the repercussions of this tsunami in Wall Street to reach the shores of Europe, and I think it started in Germany with the crash of the Dresden Anhalt Bank. We can say that Hitler came to power the day the Dresden Anhalt Bank failed, but now it will go around the world in seconds.
Yeah, and it's going to be devastating, and I've been urging the listener on both in Europe, America, and in the Pan-African listenership to prepare their families for this. It's going to be as difficult a period as any human has ever faced.
I wish I hadn't parted with the family gold. I sold it all to a Jew in Manchester illegally because it was forbidden to sell gold under Harold Wilson. And so I didn't get a very good price for it. And there were several hundred half-sovereigns, only 8 sovereigns, strangely enough. But being a traditional Scottish family, you know, they hoarded and hoarded. And I was determined to part with it because I thought it bad luck. I wish now I had held on to it because I now stare poverty in the face as a retired academic. And really, you know, when I look at this impending crash, I can only see two possibilities. One is anarchy, and the other is that to get the system, the capitalist system, out of the mess, they'll do again what they did in 1929. I mean, that great German Buddhist scholar, whose name I continually forget, he was the leading authority on Lamaist Buddhism in the whole world, and he was a visiting professor in our department at Lancaster. He says in his autobiography that he was not surprised when war came. He said, I knew it was inevitable from the moment of the Wall Street crash. And that's 4 years before the advent of Hitler. In other words, war was inevitable from that moment. So inevitable now. But Dara, I want to ask you, last time, when they had their war, their target was the Japanese and the Germans. This time, who will it be? It will be the Muslims.
It will be the Muslims and Putin.
Yeah.
Now, listen. The RAND Corporation has just done a white paper recommending the American government engage in a world war in order to get itself out of this financial mess.
Oh, well, could anything be more blatant?
No,
the boom of the last 17 years is partly generated by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, not necessarily, but, you know, it comes from this is the end of the Ponzi scheme. You know, this is a pyramid scheme, this money system. Fiat money systems always fail, and this is just the inevitable end of a runaway system that was destined to fail at some point. Yeah. But, anyway, we have reached the end of our hour, James. I want to give you an opportunity here maybe to have some parting words for our listening audience, because you are a man of wisdom and of sagesse, if you will, and it's great to have your kind and intelligent takes on things. So I'm going to give you a chance here to maybe to speak to the audience before we call it a file here.
Well, on Halloween, it's significant that we confront a night when the demons are loosed in the earth. So I ask all my listeners to look out for the living demons as well as the dead and supernatural ones, to identify them and combat them. It's our only condition of survival.
Yeah. Well, I my parting words are, ladies and gentlemen, please care for your families, because you know in what is coming, you're going to find strength and solace in close family relationships, and begin to strategize on how you're going to be strong in the face of these challenges. But more than that, tell the people around you and your friends, your colleagues, all about these facts and these truths. Tell them where to find the information. Go to my website and download the books. There are over 40 books on that site, and there are over 800 hours of interviews. 800, ladies and gentlemen, that I have done over the last 5 years. And begin to educate yourself and your friends and families so that you can survive, not only survive, but help make this place a better world in what's coming. This is Darrell Bradford Smith telling all of you, please take care of your families and be well. Bye-bye now.